I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For parents who have picky little eaters at home, there are two major concerns. What's the impact on their kids' well-being, and what can be done to expand an overly particular palate? Today, we'll get the latest from a pediatrician on what's normal for and when to worry about young selective eaters. What are the nutritional dangers of a pared-down diet, and how can parents encourage young ones to try different foods? We'll also ask a dietitian for advice on how to get kids cooking in the kitchen. Let us hear from you, too. Got a creative way to get the kiddos to finish their carrots and kale? Call in and share the wisdom. This week's Local Listen will wrap up the show. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Picky eaters. You got one in your family? This is a common complaint of parents with young kids, and it has been for eons. But what to do about it? Now, there's a question for you. Turns out there's lots of ideas out there, lots of strategies, and today we'll kick it around with a pair of experts who have spent a lot of time thinking about this very issue. With us today as part of our Children's Health Series are Shelley Summer. She's a registered dietitian over at Children's Mercy Hospital. And Shelley, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Natasha Burgert is back. She's a pediatrician at Pediatric Associates based here in Kansas City. And Natasha, good morning to you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Steve.
Well, picky eaters, Shelley, how common of a problem is this?
Well, I've experienced quite a few picky eaters as my time as registered dietitian at Children's Mercy.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of concern with parents who think it's abnormal that their kids won't eat or seem to be picky. It's really quite common.
And the problem's not going away.
No. It's been going on for generations.
And it keeps going. Keeps people like you in business, right?
That's right.
Natasha, have you seen any change, any fluctuation in the number of parents who are complaining about picky eaters in their houses?
No, I think that's a constant complaint. It seems to kind of be a social norming of sorts that people like to complain about what their kids will and won't eat. So we hear about it a lot in the office.
You know, I came across this phrase that I had never heard before last night in connection with all this, sensory food aversion. Shelley, is that just a fancy term for picky eating, or does it mean something else entirely?
Well, I think it can be a fancy term for picky eating, but there are some kids who really have sensory aversions to food.
Really?
And those are the ones that this issue is a little bit more concerning for.
Sensory aversion meaning what? They just don't like how it tastes or what the texture of the food is? Or
I think it's broader than that. So yes, those are issues, but these are kids who often can't stand to be in the same room with the food.
Really?
So the smells of it, the sight of it, the thought of it, all of those things create this aversion to eating. Most of the kids that I've seen with the more serious issues related to picky eating have other sensory issues as well. So it's not just food, but food is one way that it manifests itself in ways that become more alarming to parents.
You know, Natasha, this strikes me as so unusual because food is obviously so elemental to who we are as people, and you got to have it and all that. How can there possibly be an aversion to food?
Well, I think we have to remember, if we go way, way back to the caveman days and kind of think of the evolution, right? Like, you've got a toddler who's going to be putting everything in their mouth and exploring the world by putting everything in their mouth, and it almost seems like there has to be some sort of filter or some sort of stopgap. If those berries are going to kill you, you shouldn't put them in your mouth. And especially in toddlers, we seem that anxiety or that sense seems to be hyperacute. And some kids even more hyperacute than others, leading to true aversions. In my experience, too, in addition to other developmental disorders, like Shelley mentioned, I think kids can have true aversions after a really scary event as well. Like if kids have a choking event or if kids are really scared of vomiting, for example, and have a vomiting illness, then they won't eat anymore because they are so scared to vomit. So I think there is a natural protective factor for some of these anxieties around food, but certainly an alarming situation for families, and it needs professional help.
But Shelley, we're talking about a fairly small percentage of kids who have these really strong reactions that you're talking about here, right?
Yes. My experience is there's about 3 to 5% of kids that are going to have those really strong aversions.
Oh, still 3 to 5%. Oh, that's significant. Wait, why should anybody care about this? I mean, isn't this notion, just going back to the general idea of picky eating, isn't just a phase that a lot of little kids go through?
Well, picky eating is a phase that a lot of kids go through, but this serious aversion can result in serious health consequences. And so the reason a dietitian gets involved is for either undernutrition, so kids are very thin, aren't gaining weight or growing appropriately. And in some cases, we've seen quite the opposite. So overweight or obese and now experiencing some of the comorbid conditions that come about as a result of that.
I'm sorry, the obesity is due to what? Where does that enter in here?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question. So in kids who have special needs, we see the sensory aversion come about frequently. And so at Children's Mercy, we have a clinic that addresses this for kids who are overweight and have a special need as well. So we are seeing these kids who are overweight and obese, so carrying a significant amount of extra weight, and yet they only eat 5 or 6 different foods. Frequently, those are foods that are very high in calories, and they're over-consuming them. In addition, this is a population that are frequently reinforced with food, so their behaviors are reinforced with food, which in many cases contributes to the problem.
Wow. Natasha, in sort of the rank and file kids who come through your office and the parents who are struggling with picky eating, what are kids being picky about? I mean, what are they objecting to? Is it the taste, the texture? What is it?
That is a great question, because when you say picky eating to me, then the first thing I'm going to ask is, well, what do you mean by that? Like, there's no real definition of what a picky eater is. It's kind of like
it's a trash can.
It's a huge range. So some parents are going to complain that their kids are actually just having small volumes of food. They have a lot of variety of different foods. They just eat 1 or 2 bites. To the other extreme, where kids will only eat things if they are yellow and orange and the crust cut off. You know, that they get very particular about the foods that they like to be served.
Yeah.
And kind of everything in between. So the first challenge when talking to a nutritionist, anyone in dietetics or a pediatrician, is really defining what the parent is observing to be the problem before we try to talk about a solution.
To what extent, Shelly, can you help kids who have these, problems to the point where they're actually losing weight, not gaining weight? I mean, what do you do with those kids?
At Children's Mercy, we've seen those kids in a multidisciplinary clinic. So we have a dietitian, frequently a pediatrician, as well as an occupational therapist. And in some cases, we'll have a psychologist involved as well. So it sort of depends on, to Dr. Natasha's point, it depends on the scope of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
How bad is it? How long has it been going on? How ingrained is this? And what other issues are going on with the child that might be impacting this condition?
Do some kids actually become inpatients? Are they staying in the hospital?
We have had some that did require an inpatient stay, typically because their nutrition was so poor that we had to provide them nutrition in other supplemental ways. That's quite rare. That's really an exception.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wouldn't want parents who are listening to this think that, oh my gosh, my child needs an inpatient hospital stay. No, that is not the case. But frequently requires significant and regular therapy or treatment for these very serious aversions. So not just I can't get my kid to eat broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
That's not it. This is what Dr. Natasha was saying, the child who only eats 5 foods, they're all yellow and they have to be a particular shape.
Parents who are listening to this, Natasha, they're going to be wondering, is there a chance their kid could starve to death? I mean, is that a concern here, or what would you say to that?
I think that's always the fear, right? I
mean,
we always have our hang-ups, and we really feel we love our kids. We know the importance of their nutrition. And so when they're not consuming the foods that we took the time to prepare, that we took the money to prepare, it gets really frustrating. But there have been some interesting studies, and when we're looking at some just kids, the average healthy, normal, growing kids who have kind of food jags or food tendencies, they're not nutritionally deficient.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are born with the innate sense to know when they're hungry. They know when they're not hungry. And I think sometimes our interventions can backfire. We're not reinforcing those natural tendencies. And so for the vast majority of kids, when they go through this process, they're not truly going to starve to death. They're not going to choose to starve. our interpretation of what they're consuming, though, is inadequate and causes us anxiety.
I'm wondering, just speaking broadly here, Shelley, very much in general, do parents tend to overreact to this issue? Would they generally be better off if they just took a chill pill?
Well, I think it's always good for parents to be paying attention. I think it's good to be bringing these issues up to your pediatrician or physician when you're going in for your doctor's visits, and it's never too early to start that conversation. So I hesitate to say they're overreacting. I do think in some cases they may perceive it to be a bigger problem than it actually is.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to some get our listeners to get involved here. We want to know from them, if you've dealt with picky eaters, how did you handle getting your child to eat not just enough food, but the right foods? What was your strategy for dealing with all this? 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Ken from Lee's Summit. Ken, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of things. I'm 58, and maybe it's generational. I'm not sure, but my parents raised five of us, and we would have never dreamed of rejecting whatever our mother put out in front of us because we were truly hungry when we sat at the table each day. And B, had you rejected anything, now this is, of course, over 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age, you would have got corked across the head with a wooden spoon. And that's just the way it was in those days. I remember no friends, contemporaries, or neighbors ever saying, I won't eat that, I don't eat that, he doesn't eat that. We ate what was put in front of us, and we enjoyed it.
Is that the way to handle this issue? Maybe Ken's cutting through all the clutter here. Is that the way to deal with this, Shelley, or not?
I think we do deal with eating a little bit differently than we did in the past. And I think one of the things that, you know, I've heard my dad say this before, same sorts of things. You didn't think about refusing anything because you were so hungry, you were eating anything that was left over. But I also think that at that time, they were also more involved with food and eating our food, preparing it, growing it, bringing it into the house. And I think in many situations, kids today aren't that involved with doing it. We are not eating as many foods that we have to prepare on our own, where we might be opening up more boxes or things like that. And so there's not as much exposure to the food. And exposure to the food is really important when you're thinking about picky eating.
Oh, that's really interesting. Ken, I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good day, Ken. I appreciate it. What are normal eating behaviors in toddlers and preschoolers, Natasha? How would you describe what normal eating is?
Well, normal eating in a toddler is really, really varied. I have certainly met many, many toddlers that are voracious eaters that eat everything and they love whatever their parents prepare. But I think I think we have to think about a couple things when we think about toddlers eating. As first is their serving size. I think in general in our country we have a little we overestimate what an average serving size is for an adult, and we really overestimate what a serving size is for a kid. So in general, for a toddler, a serving size is 1 tablespoon per year of age. Which is not that much, right? So having a couple pieces of broccoli, quite honestly, might be a serving size for a kid that's 2 or 3. However, what I'm going to hear in the clinic is he never eats his broccoli. Mm-hmm. So I think getting a handle on what a true serving size is for a toddler could really, really calm a lot of parents' nerves and really let them appreciate that their toddler is actually eating quite a bit.
Maybe subconsciously we're encouraging our kids to overeat at a very young age.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's absolutely
true. Well, that's a concern,
isn't it? No, it's totally true. And not only that they're overeating, but we're totally taking away their ability to discern that on their own, especially with distraction tactics that we try. And let's put them in front of the TV or let's give them an iPad so they just keep eating because it makes us feel better because they're eating a whole bunch. Or we're going to make them eat 3 bites of everything before they get something else. We do all these games and these tricks that I think end up just decreasing our own anxiety without actually having our kids develop a really healthy relationship with food, and that's a problem.
Shelley, you're nodding your head here pretty strongly. Yes, we're encouraging our kids to eat too much.
Not only are we encouraging our kids to eat too much, we're encouraging them to eat for the wrong reasons, to have a game played with them or to get attention or those sorts of things. We should be eating because we're hungry and we need the food to nourish our bodies, and that mealtime should be about eating and not about playing games.
Yeah, one of the things I found yesterday from one expert online is this notion that you should never trick your kids into eating anything.
I have seen patients that have come into clinic that have these aversions because they were tricked and they ate something that they didn't know they were eating. And so I encourage parents to not draw attention that's not needed to the food. And so you don't need to make a big production that you're providing chicken when in reality you're giving them pork or something else. I think you don't need to draw attention to those things. It's food. This is what we're eating. If you want to know what it is, I'm happy to answer that question. I'm going to answer it honestly because it is it has resulted in some kids in less eating, so worse food jags.
Yeah, and I completely agree with Shelley, especially with families that try to hide different things and different things, or I'm going to make you a smoothie, but really it has these bizarre ingredients in it. Like, if the kid, I think there is something to be respected as an individual person. If you really have an aversion to that product, I shouldn't force another person to do that.
I'm going to repeat this notion you mentioned just a minute or two ago, this idea that one tablespoon of food per year of age might be the acceptable amount for a lot of kids. Again, that's going to surprise a lot of people.
Because it's not a lot.
It's not a lot.
It's not a lot. And I think when we look at our own plates, we don't have a good perception of what a normal adult serving size is. And we translate that to our kids. And that really ends up causing a lot of arguments and stress and anxiety and fights at the table that probably aren't needed.
And families have a lot of fights and a lot of stress over this. Shelley, you probably have seen a lot of that firsthand.
Yes. And I think the dinner table should be reserved for camaraderie, conversation. It should be a happy place. It should be a happy time. It should be something that we look forward to and want to engage in with our family. And when we create fights about it, you didn't eat whatever, or those sorts of things, I think it results in, especially in adolescence, really driving our kids not to be at the dinner table or not want to enjoy that family time. But it's really key from a developmental standpoint, a behavioral standpoint, from a relationship building standpoint. Lots of important benefits of eating family meals.
The scourge of picky eating is our topic here today. We're looking for ways to get around it and deal with it. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Kimberly from Overland Park. Kimberly, good morning.
Hi. I want to thank you guys so much for having this topic on the show, because I was going to call for an appointment at the hospital because I've got an ADHD with an oppositional defiance on board. She will not eat breakfast. She does not like the school lunch that Shawnee Mission presents. And she thinks a happy meal is a snack. Red beans and rice and, you know, Casey Jones, that's a snack, mommy. I want to go to Jay Gilbert. I've exposed her to some quality foods and she rejects the peanut butters and the jellies. Yesterday she said, Mom, who would put nuts and fruits together? She's 8 years old, but she's got a bottomless pit for a stomach, and she's always hungry. I don't know if she needs a vitamin. She's very thin. She's on risperidone and Focalin, but we need medical intervention so that we can satisfy her as a family. And I'm not always in tears, and Grandma's not always in tears. You know, she only wants tuna from Costco, Mommy, not from Hy-Vee. It's bizarre.
How about some help, some advice for Kimberly? Either one.
Well, I'm sorry that you're having so much trouble, Kimberly. That's not a way that's not going to be good for anyone in the house. And certainly your story is not unique, especially with kids that are on medications that affect appetite and have underlying disorders that make them more sensitive to, and particular to, different things in their environment in general. It really escalates when it comes to food. Absolutely, the first thing I would recommend is seeing your pediatrician. I think that's a good call to make a medical consult, because one of the things we have to really figure out too is where she is on the growth curve, how she's doing. She may need, especially with those medications that she's taking, it's not uncommon that we might do a little bit of an investigation on her to make sure there isn't another problem that her body has that is making her have those tendencies. But I think it's certainly willing to give a call, if not to get some reassurance that she's growing, get some good ideas of some food options for her, and to decrease some of that fighting that you're having at home.
I hope that helps, Kimberly.
It does. Thank you, guys.
Good luck. Yeah. Bye-bye. Thanks. Kelly from Kansas City. Kelly, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks. I was calling because I had a kiddo who was tube-fed. He was fed on a feeding tube. Wow. Until he was almost five, because of a learned feeding aversion that he acquired with uncontrolled reflux. And I have to say, I mean, he had a lot going on. He was a preemie, but the thing that ended up being the most frustrating to overcome was the feeding aversion, and it was really hard to find resources to help with that.
You're saying
he's 15 now, and he eats.
But, Kelly, you're saying he was throwing up a lot of what he was eating, if I'm following you right.
Right. So I guess it's pretty common with premature babies to have reflux. And to keep him on the growth curve at the time that he was born, there was just a lot of pressure to keep tube feeding him so that his weight stayed on and he could get on the growth curve. When Natasha said about sometimes our interventions backfire, I do think he never developed that innate sense of hunger. And even now as a 15-year-old, he eats well and he's healthy. But it's much more of a cognitive effort for him to think about, you know, what should I eat, when should I eat, and that sort of thing. There's not a whole lot natural about it. He's had to learn it through feeding therapy that went from the time he was like 3 till he was 6. It was...
Yeah.
Definitely the biggest challenge.
This notion,
much more texture driven.
Kelly, hang on. This notion that some kids really never develop this feeling of hunger, how common is that?
Well, I think Kelly's story about her son is a little exceptional in the fact that he had some very serious medical issues being that premature, and we're very thankful that we were able to intervene to support his growth when he was young. But she's exactly right. Like, I think her story is a testament to how important these innate skills are as a formative skill that develops in youth. And if there are medical issues or medical conditions that are interfering with that growth, it has lifelong consequences. I'm glad to hear that he's recovered now that he's older, but I can't imagine how stressful that was when he was younger, both to make sure that he was growing and to get over that hump. I think that her story is important in that when we're trying to intervene during those younger years, sometimes we are creating an issue.
Yeah. Okay, Kelly, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about picky eaters. We'll turn to some do's and don'ts, and we'll get phone calls from Florence and Rachel and Laura. So if you guys could hang on, that would be great. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow we'll hear a controversial perspective on oppression and race relations in the U.S., and we'll discuss the current and future prospects of the Kansas State budget with Sean Sullivan. He's the state of Kansas's budget director. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. This hour we're talking about picky eaters with Shelley Summer. She's a registered dietitian over at Children's Mercy. Dr. Natasha Burgert's also here, a pediatrician at Pediatric Associates. This is one of our regular Children's Health Series programs. You know, Shelley, there's been this research on this issue, and we've learned there may be this link between low frequency of family meals and low fruit and vegetable intake. What do we know about that? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and we do hear that the more frequently you have family meals, the better the nutritional content of your overall diet happens to be. And we think one of those reasons is because the types of things that you offer when you're having family meals. Mm-hmm. So you're in the kitchen, you're preparing the meal, or preparing a wider variety of things. You're more likely to eat those as well. So family meals are really important from a nutritional standpoint. They're important for bonding. They're just an important opportunity to get back together as a family.
There's this notion that getting kids in the kitchen, and Shelley, you've alluded to this a couple of times here this morning, to help prepare food might actually help here. Tell us about this and what's the idea behind it?
Well, we often think there are just two steps to eating. You sit down in front of the food and then you put it in your mouth.
That's the way to approach it.
It would be nice. Yes. It would be nice if that was all you had to do, but there are actually a number of steps.
Hate it. Yeah.
There are a number of steps to eating that most people don't even think about. And the first one being able to tolerate being in the same room with the food. And then you have to tolerate that food becoming coming closer to you and eventually right underneath
you. And working with it, maybe.
Yes. And then you have to tolerate it with your hands before you're able to tolerate it in your mouth. For many people, those things are done very quickly, and you don't even think about the number of steps that you're doing to actually eat a food. But for kids with serious food aversions, there are lots of barriers in there. And so one of the things we really encourage is it's okay to play with your food.
Mm-hmm.
As an infant, when you are introduced to food, we want kids picking up the food and putting it in their mouth and testing it and trying it, being exposed to it. Because if you don't, my observation is that if kids don't tolerate the food with their fingertips, they're not going to tolerate it when it gets up to their mouth or in their mouth.
Hmm.
I also encourage families, as they're working on these real serious eating issues, that it is okay to kiss the food. It is okay to lick the food without having to eat it. And that is one of the steps in actually being able to tolerate. We often have
Because you're getting kids warmed up to the idea of actually chewing on it. Yeah.
And working against their sensory issues. In addition, put it in your mouth, hold it there. So these are all practices that we have kids who are in feeding therapy work on. And those are steps that have to be tolerated before you can actually expect the kid to chew, swallow, and then add the food to their regular diet on a regular basis.
Natasha, I imagine you have to be a little bit careful with some young kids and what they're doing in the kitchen, because that could get a little crazy pretty quickly.
It's true, but I think that there's a lot of resources online. Definitely, there's a lot of videos and a lot of sites that have encouraged what Shelley's trying to promote, and that's to get young kids in the kitchen in a safe way to have them experience the food, not only in the preparation, but maybe in the planning, maybe in the buying, taking them to the grocery store and having them pick out something that smells or looks interesting. That certainly worked with my kids. If they got to pick it out and to put it in their basket and they took it home, they were much more likely to try it themselves, even if it was a bite or two. So I think what it comes down to is for most kids, and certainly Shelley works with some of our kids that really need extensive help, but for most kids, it's experiencing the entire process, and it's prioritizing that as part of the ritual in your home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's difficult for a lot of people. A lot of busy working families, it's a lot easier to grab the Happy Meal and just throw it in the back seat and have it be done. But we're losing the value of the full experience of food, and we're losing the value of the relationships that are made and the time that we remember spending with our mom in the kitchen. It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be gourmet. We're talking about simple, making mac and cheese and making pizzas, but it's still something that they're going to create not only a good relationship with food and maybe try a few new things, but they're going to remember doing that with their mom. And I think that's really important.
Is this phrase I hear, mealtime prep intervention? Is that the term that's applied to just going in the kitchen and helping your mom or dad make dinner?
Likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my first time to actually hear that. But
yeah. Okay. Let's go back to some phone calls as we kick around picky eaters here. Let's go to Rachel from Lee's Summit. Rachel, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
My daughter is almost 10. And when she was a toddler, me and my friends and cousins, we all kind of had babies at the same time. And I've had really great success with her not becoming a picky eater. But I noticed along the way, especially when she was a toddler, she would go through these phases where she thought she didn't like something. Even things that she had eaten before, she would just get this idea into her head that she didn't like it, she didn't want to eat it. And I had a lot of success with not forcing her to eat, but not giving her something else either. And I noticed that a lot of my other parental counterparts weren't doing the same thing with their kids. And it kind of built up this process, this step-by-step, where the child would say, this is bad. And the parent says, okay, that is bad, and gives them something else instead. Like, by giving them something else instead, they're kind of reinforcing the child's idea that this food is bad and they shouldn't eat it.
Yeah, both our experts, Rachel, are nodding their heads. Natasha, what are you thinking?
Yeah, Rachel, you need to talk more about this to your friends. I think you have a good attitude. You're right on point. And I think I think this comes back to sometimes we intervene too much. And if a child is not hungry for something or says that they don't like it, then the consequence to that is that they go hungry or they don't get another option. That's only going to fuel their appetite for the next time that they do have an organized time to get food. I think one of the really the things that's currently driving me crazy in the office is the pouches of pureed foods that are given to kids that don't eat pureed foods anymore for this exact same reason. And they don't like what's being served or whatever. Well, I can squeeze something in your mouth that has like quinoa and beets in it and it makes me feel better, totally undermining that natural cue and that ability to have a consequence to not trying something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rachel, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's go to Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Florence, good morning.
Good morning, hostie and guests. I'm a grandmother who raised two children, and I have raised four grandchildren, so I've been through many of these issues. However, could the guest share with us something about the science of food combining for proper digestion in children's food intake? The science of eating, why we eat.
The food combining flow. What are you talking about there exactly?
Food combining proteins, carbohydrates, citrus and fruits.
Okay.
Well, I think... Yeah.
What happens to the food when it gets down into the stomach?
So what we eat, how it affects our digestion, I guess, Natasha.
Sure, yeah. And I think...
Enzyme system.
Yeah, I think to Florence's point and what she may be alluding to is the importance of balance and that each different kind of food, whether it's a carbohydrate or a protein or a fat, is going to be used by our bodies in different ways. So, for example, if you have a kid that's a fruit bat and just loves fruit, and a ton of carbohydrates, what's going to be happening to their insulin levels and their sugar levels and their glucose levels and how their body's going to respond to that is going to be much different than if a kid like really loves proteins and all the time is eating nuts and those kind of things are going to be processed from their body in certainly different ways. And especially when we're talking about toddlers, we want them to have some kind of food groups in every single size. So we're not getting just carbohydrates or just fats or just proteins and having that balance, because to Florence's point, they truly are digested and used in the body different ways in order to be those building blocks for growth.
Okay. Florence, always appreciate it. Thanks for the good call. Laura from Shawnee. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. My case may be a little different, but I am a mother of three, and I've had really great success with my first two being good eaters. We try lots of different foods and have family meal time. But this third child of ours is proving to be quite different.
Yeah.
And we are currently – he's going to talk in the background while I'm talking. we are currently doing G-tube feeding. He has basically, he's 11 months old and refused to eat solids up until now. So we're frequent flyers at Children's Mercy. But one of the questions I have for you all is, what kind of support services or groups are out there for parents? I have found that maybe because my other two, I didn't have these issues. Between appointments at Children's Mercy, it's a pretty lonely world out there, and it's difficult to get a sense of how long does this last for others? What have others tried? Do others see and feel and have these same experiences? And what kind of things are around Kansas City that are for parents of children like this in different age groups?
Oh, Laura, I appreciate that. I was just going to say, once you get your 11-year-old on the phone here, and we'll have Shelley Summer talk to him and just straighten everything out here all of a sudden.
But well, he's 11 months. He's 11 months, not 11 years. So talking is
I recognize that. I recognize that. What about support for parents like Laura, Shelley?
Yeah, Laura, I think that's an excellent question.
I do, too.
And I think that's an excellent idea. I'm not entirely sure that there is much available right now in terms of parental support, but I do hear that parents are going through the same thing and think there'd be great value in doing that.
Maybe Children's Mercy might want to think about something like that. Yeah.
And I've had a couple patients, Laura, that have found feeding groups on Facebook that have been like private groups that are serious parents that have kids with similar feeding issues, especially with G-tube fed. So I know that they're out there online if they may not be here in Kansas City, because I agree with you, listening to other people's experience, especially when your child's going through a very unique event is very valuable, and you guys can share really cool ideas amongst yourselves, which is great. So I know they're online. I know they're out there. Facebook would be the first place I'd check.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Laura, good luck. We'll be thinking about you. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Let's go to Sarah from Kansas City, Missouri. Sarah, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to share, I have a 12-year-old now who has been a picky eater basically since birth. Hmm. And I mean really picky. He does have some sensory issues, but I truly believe that he has and has in the past had a phobia of trying new foods. Not just picky, but just an actual fear, and that's based on just trying so many things with him. So, you know, everyone tells you as a parent, like, you should make them eat the food, and you should, you know, you make the thing, and then they have to eat it, and you don't give them any other options, which kind of makes you feel ashamed as a parent when you have a picky eater, because you're trying these things and they're not doing it. So we tried games. We tried, I hate to even admit this, but I tried paying him $5 to try a new food. And the way that
did it work
is that, well, no. And here's what happened. I offered him $5 to try a bite of chicken. And by the end of that meal, he was crying because he wanted the $5, but he was so afraid to try the chicken that he could not make himself do it. So it was really heartbreaking as a parent. And so finally, actually, it was kind of that incident that made me realize this is not worth it. And this struggle and this trying to force him to do something is hurting all of us. And I just gave up, and I just said, you know, you will eat. Thankfully, he liked fruits and vegetables, so he would eat his fruits and vegetables, and I would make him noodles, and the rest of us would eat our food, and I would offer it to him. And finally, within the last 2 years, like I said, he's 12, he, on his own, started trying things. He smelled one time I was making steak, and he's like, that smells good. And I said, you should try it if you want, and he did. And so now he is eating just basically everything. And even as a 12-year-old, he starts trying new things. He'll be in a restaurant and see something and say, I want to try that. And I never thought it would happen. But I truly believe that when I finally took the pressure off of him and made it more casual and let him decide, that is when he decided to open up his palate. And I guess that's my suggestion to other parents, is just to not put so much pressure on yourself as a parent, and not put so much pressure on your child to change themselves.
Sarah, that is such a great story, and I imagine you agree, Shelley. That summarized a lot of what we're talking about here today.
It is a great story, and I love that he's now open to trying new foods. Mm-hmm. I will mention that there's an approach that we use in clinics at Children's Mercy called the food scientist.
I was going to say, are you paying people to eat over there, or is that not really part of the curriculum?
We are not yet paying them to eat.
Not going there, yeah.
But what we do
pay
is...
Pay me to eat, that'd be a good deal.
I'd like that as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We do like to take the pressure off because this should be exploration of food. And so in this food scientist approach, what we really try to do is engage kids in the conversation about food related to the senses. So what does it look like? Describe it. What does it smell like? And you can learn a lot when you hear kids describing how they see a food or what they think it smells like or mm-hmm. what it tastes like. Touching it, what does it feel like? What does it sound like when you put it in your mouth? And so helping kids identify what is the real issue they have with a particular food can help you learn a lot and help direct the approach you're going to take in helping to get them to eat a wider variety.
All right. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, just so we're getting a little short of time, but as we think about some of these things for the parents who are listening, one rule of thumb, I think I'm hearing you both say, never force a child to touch, taste, or eat food. Am I hearing that right?
Absolutely.
You don't want to force them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And playing tricks, again, based on Sarah's call here, you don't want to be there either.
No, worth it.
Yeah. And the other thing I read was transition gradually and incrementally. Slow change here. Don't have to rush anything.
We like to call that the just noticeable difference.
The which one?
Just noticeable difference.
Okay.
So it would be changing one of the sensory aspects of the food, but just one of them. An really easy example is changing the shape of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So instead of cutting it in squares, cut it in triangles. Use a cookie cutter. That would be a just noticeable difference. Another example, and it may not be the best one, but if you think about the different flavors of Cheerios, they all look essentially the shape and the sound of them are going to be the same, but you're changing the taste.
Mm-hmm.
So apple cinnamon versus plain. Okay, so that just noticeable difference is just enough that the kids notice, but not so much to create them or to create an exaggerated response, like scare them about eating the new food.
What's your favorite one?
Cheerios?
Yeah. Where do you go with that?
Honey Nut.
Honey Nut. All day long.
And again, one other point you all made today was it's okay to encourage kids to play with food away from the table, perhaps, and not eat it, Natasha.
No, that's completely true, and especially away from the table. If the location is causing anxiety and all a child knows is we fight around this table about this, then get them away from it. I mean, it's beautiful outside today. Go have a picnic. Go outside. Change the environment in another way, and you might be surprised.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Let's go to Catherine from Shawnee. Catherine, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I know we don't want to encourage tricks, but I have a three-year-old girl, and she was a 27-week preemie, so I struggled with her eating. So what I would do is take oatmeal and bananas and any vegetable, whether it was cabbage or carrots or spinach, and I would puree. And so she would always get different breakfast puree in the morning. Eventually, she started taking eating avocados on its own, and now she's taking bites of corn. So it's a gradual phase. I just wanted to say sometimes you just have to let parents experiment and find the best answer, you know, because if you say you can't trick them to eat something, you know, like the puree I make every morning.
Right.
Then what sort of vegetables will they eat? you know, they don't eat any vegetables.
Catherine, I appreciate the call. Why don't you guys react to that?
I love the experimenting. I think that's great. And I think one of the important things to remember is there's a difference between tricking and offering new foods without saying anything about it. So there's absolutely nothing wrong. I would encourage creating these wonderful blends of food that you're going to expose your children to. And you don't have to say anything about it. You don't have to say, oh, I put cabbage in there. Oh, ha ha, you ate broccoli. I think it's really important to leave that as very, very neutral. But if
That's
they ask the question and answer the question honestly, but don't provide them with don't provide them with unnecessary information.
I get one more call here from Jack from Topeka, who was an extremely picky eater himself and has managed to survive and talk about it. Jack, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I guess I'd like to speak to one the call about the phobic eater child, as well as kind of the food scientist idea. So I was definitely there. If an onion looked at my food wrong, I'd be running the other way for a long time. what my parents did was typically just make a second meal for me, and release that pressure that another caller was talking about, and that was tiresome. But what my dad did was started to involve me in the cooking process, and I realized when I was making food for other people, or at least helping, I was more liable to try it myself, to see the different faces of food, onions cooked versus uncooked, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, I'm cooking on my own when my parents aren't there, even at a young age. And like, I think it helped to explore the world on my own, as well as develop a useful skill. So that kind of idea of the food scientist was a a really good idea.
I'm really glad you called, and that's maybe a great note to end our show on picky eaters on here. I want to thank Shelley Summer. She's a registered dietitian over at Children's Mercy. Dr. Natasha Burgert, a pediatrician at Pediatric Associates here in Kansas City. Thank you both for a very good conversation. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. Last Wednesday, we got Trump, but KCOR contributor Bill Brownlee is back this week, and he brought with him the latest Local Listen. And Bill, nice to have you. How are you?
Glad to be back.
You want to talk about Mama's Boy. Who are they?
Well, I don't know if the four young men in Mama's Boy, Steve, are picky eaters or not. But
you're not sure. You didn't do that research yet, eh?
But I can tell you that, tellingly, their new EP that's being released this week is titled Liquid Courage.
Liquid Courage. Let's listen to Mama's Boy and a track from Liquid Courage. That's Mama's Boy, the track Be Good Boy from the new EP Liquid Courage. And Bill, you say Mama's Boy reminds you of a couple of bands out of the 60s and 70s. Like who?
Yeah, I think we're hearing a little bit of groups like the Chocolate Watch Band, who play that, you know, psychedelic garage rock of the 60s. And then I hear elements, too, of 70s new wave groups like the Greg Kinn Band.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got that sloppy sound, and but there's a little bit of pop here too.
You mentioned garage rock, and there's a revival going on in Kansas City. At least that's what you're thinking.
Yeah, there are all these Kansas City and Lawrence bands that are better than any right they have to be. Groups like Mama's Boy, who are brand new, but they're the Conquerors or Psychic Heat, bands playing this rough rock, intentionally primitive sound, but boy, they're really good.
Yeah, and there's a sense here that this song has kind of an unseasonably, it's good for an unseasonably warm day. It's got a summery quality to it.
It sure does, and for what it's worth, this song has been haunting me at night. I just can't get it out of my head when I'm trying to sleep.
Why does that happen?
You know, I don't know what causes an earworm, and like,
man,
I said,
these
kids shouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah,
but yet here we are.
But there are two shows this weekend to celebrate the release of Mama Boy's new debut EP, Liquid Courage. What do we know about that?
They're at the Replay Lounge in Lawrence on Thursday, and at the Tank Room on Saturday. They'll be playing with a couple area bands, Scruffing the Janitors and Rachel Malin's group.
I was going to say, they're sharing the bill here with some other folks, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of compatible bands they had to choose from, and in both cases, Thursday and Saturday, they chose wisely.
Well, the group again is Mama's Boy, the track Be Good Boy from the new EP, Liquid Courage. And Bill, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for the good recommendation.
Thanks, Steve.
You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, what is white rage and how does it affect race relations? We're going to find out. And we'll get the Kansas budget director's take on this state's fiscal conundrum. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.